Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why, like you, he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest occupies a unique and highly acclaimed place in the world of entertainment. He's a playwright, actor, director, novelist, cabaret performer, and drag legend whose characters evoke the great cinematic actresses of the golden age of Hollywood. As a young man, his ambition was to have his own theatrical troupe and write camp, movie-inspired comedies in which he could play the leading lady in drag. And that he did. He's written and starred in over 25 plays, including The Divine Sister, The Lady in Question, Red Scare on Sunset, The Tribute Artist, The Confession of Lily Dare, and one of my all-time favorites, Pardon My Inquisition or Kiss the Blood Off My Castanets, starring our guest in the dual roles of the tempestuous Spitfire prostitute Maria Garbanzo and her lookalike, the tragic noblewoman, the Marquesa del Drago. And I can't resist mentioning his hilariously camp and heartwarming classic Christmas show, Times Square Angel, which has been performed annually for over 30 years. But there can be no doubt that in the world of theater, our guest is best known for two of his hit plays, Vampire Lesbians of Sodom, which is one of the longest running plays in the history of Off-Broadway, and his smash long running Broadway hit, The Tale of the Allergist's Wife, which earned a Tony Award nomination for Best Play and won our guest the Outer Circle Critics Award for Playwriting. He also wrote and starred in the film versions of his plays Psycho Beach Party and Die Mommy Die, which won him the Best Performance Award at the Sundance Film Festival. He also directed the film A Very Serious Person, starring Polly Bergen, which won an honorable mention at the Tribeca Film Festival. On television, for two seasons, he appeared as Nat Ginsburg on the highly acclaimed HBO series Oz. He's a well-respected expert in film and theater history, and he's appeared as a guest programmer and in numerous documentaries for Turner Classic Movies, and he's lectured and conducted master classes at many colleges and universities throughout America. He's a two-time MAC Award winner, and in 2003, he received a Special Drama Desk Award for career achievement as both performer and playwright. He also received the Flora Roberts Award for sustained achievement in the theater by the Dramatists Guild. He is also the subject of the acclaimed documentary film, The Lady in Question is Charles Bush. And his CD, Charles Bush Live at Feinstein's 54 Below, is one of the best cabaret albums out there, an absolute joy from beginning to end. As an author, he wrote an autobiographical novel in 1995 entitled Whores of Lost Atlantis. And now, finally, he's released his captivating, witty, insightful, and poignant memoir entitled Leading Lady, A Memoir of a Most Unusual Boy, in which he recounts a life as a trailblazer lived with authenticity and purpose. I'm delighted to welcome the incomparable Charles Bush to our show. Charles, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, I'm exhausted hearing that. My life is flying before my eyes. Oh my God.
Well, anyway, it's precisely because you lived a life like that, that your memoir is so captivating. You wrote that you viewed your life as a narrative while you were living it. What did you mean by that?
Well, It seems I've just always been interested. Storytelling is just a part of my DNA. And I just found from the beginning that somehow I was able to, while I was having experience, I could step out of it and be almost watching the movie of my life. And so consequently, I'd see the story while I'm living it. And sometimes I'd affect the story by, you know, throwing myself into circumstances that I thought would be really fun and really, so let's see where it takes me.
Well, I must tell you, I loved your book. And for me, the real star who shines all the way through this book in terms of giving you license to pursue your artistic vision and giving you a moral compass is your beloved Aunt Lil. We all need an Aunt Lil in our lives.
Oh, thank you so much, Harvey. One of the things that I wanted to achieve with the book was I really wanted to paint a full portrait of this extraordinary woman who's saved my life. And I think I'm one of the few people who can say that my parental figure made every right choice for me, because she knew what her raw material was. And then what do I do with this raw material? I'm so eternally grateful for having her. And you know, she could be sort of difficult. And I hope in the book that I've shown some of the ambiguities in her very complex personality.
Your Aunt Lil used to say that you can learn everything you need to know about a woman by the way she applies her lipstick. Have you found that to be true?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One time, I forget what play of mine it was. I think it might have been The Lady in Question years ago. And I walked into the girls' dressing room, you know, with my cup of tea before the performance. They're all putting on their makeup. And I actually had that in mind. I thought, oh, look at that. You know, my friend McGann was very, you know, carefully lining her lip and so meticulous and with this very beautiful expression on her face. And there was kind of this marvelous sense of self-love in a good way. And then my dear friend Julie Halston, who's kind of like really my non-birth sister, she was just putting on this big lipstick on her face. And I don't know quite what that said about her, than she just the joy of being at doing a show, you know, and just putting on the face. It was fascinating. And I think my aunt had a real point.
I know you wrote a sitcom pilot about Aunt Lil, but have you based any of the characters in your plays on her?
Not really. No, I've often thought about trying to write a play about her or her and I together, but I'm not that kind of playwright. It would demand a certain kind of lyrical realism, and then I'm much more stylized comic writer.
If you're a coffee lover like me, it's always fun to discover a great new blend. I recently found a terrific new company, Breakfast at Dominique's, that's created a series of coffee blends to honor the legacies of the greatest Hollywood legends. And I'm thrilled to tell you that now, Breakfast at Dominique's has introduced the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend. It's my very own exclusive, delicious, bold, rich, balanced medium roast coffee, and I just know you're going to love it. It's made from high quality organic beans produced using fair trade practices. If you'd like a great cup of coffee, give Breakfast at Dominique's a try and order the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend at HollywoodBlends.com. They'll ship it right to your door anywhere in the world. Sipping our coffee is the perfect way to watch our show. Your Aunt Lil once told you that your recurring problem in every aspect of your life is your inability to anticipate. What do you think she meant by that?
Oh, it's so true. She always kept telling me since I was a very young child, because she always spoke to me as an adult, even as when I was very little. And she said, your problem is that you must learn the mechanics of living. And I just haven't. Changing a light bulb is a bit of an issue for me. Not necessarily the screwing in, but let's say this is a perfect example. Okay, light bulb goes out. I got to change it. Oh, I have no light bulbs here. I got to go to the store, run to the store, Well, it turns out I didn't really look at what the light, I didn't bring the old light bulb with me. And let's say it's a halogen thing maybe. And so I get to the hardware store and I don't know what I'm supposed to buy. So I have to go all the way back. I don't anticipate.
You wrote that the life and career of Sarah Bernhardt has been your driving inspiration. Why her?
Oh, gosh. Many people think, when they think about me as a writer, whatever, that it's classic film is my, must be my great interest all my life. And it was, but really even more than that, theater history was my fascination. And from a very early age, my aunt got me a book that was very old when she found it secondhand in a thrift shop, this big picture book called Stars of the American Stage. And I think it was published in 1950. And there's little profiles of all these famous actors going back from Lillian Russell in the 1890s to the very young upcoming actress Maureen Stapledon is the last one. And I just would pore over these pictures. And particularly when I saw photos of Sarah Bernhardt, who was this really, I mean, I guess she was thought of as the last great actress of the 19th century, although she kept acting till she was very old in the 1920s. But she was the first international superstar. She was very much like Barbara Streisand in a certain sense that she created her own form of beauty that hadn't existed before. And in an era that where women were also very big and, you know, hourglass, she was sort of thin and rather consumptive and had a kind of this more exotic allure. And she invented, you know, an appreciation for that kind of different beauty. She was a playwright, director, sculptress. She had her own company. She had her own theater in Paris. It's just I could go on for an hour just telling you all about Sarah Bernhardt, but the fact that, you know, she really did it, created herself, was a great inspiration to me.
You described yourself as a child as a nonconformist little boy whose talents in acting, writing, and painting separated and protected you from a harsh world. You wrote your first full-length play called Lovely Lace at the age of 12, and you described it as a perfect blend of the heiress and the Barretts of Wimpole Street. Where did your creativity come from?
I think we're just, you know, born genetically with it, but I was allowed for it to develop. I was encouraged. It was a strange thing for me that I was never scholastic. I could never really function in a classroom situation. And so, and when I was a kid, I had enormous powers of concentration when it was, you know, studying Sarah Bernhardt or something like that. But when it came to, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic, I just wasn't present. At a certain point, it caught up to me. And in eighth grade, when I was going to be left back and flunk out of school, and that's when my aunt stepped in, because I had been living in the suburbs, and then she came in and took me to live with her in New York City. My mother, her sister, had died when I was seven, and my father had remarried and kind of had his own life, and so my aunt legally adopted me when I was 14. Yeah, I was this very creative child, and it was odd that here I was, right, you know, tossing off full length plays at 12 years old, but in my suburban school, I was just thought of as this kind of non-entity, not particularly interesting.
Well, as a kid, you immersed yourself in the classic women's movies of the 30s and 40s, and many of your plays were inspired by classic movies. But did you draw on your own life experiences as well when you wrote your plays?
I think everything is autobiographical, and you don't even know it. It comes, any creative idea, whether it's the silliest kind of, you know, movie pip spoof, anything, it comes out of you just rather like a dream. And I think if you analyze it, and if you choose to, you would see that that particular story has some sort of resonance on whatever losses you might have had, or if feelings of inadequacy or strength or defiance that I think you could interpret as autobiographical. I don't think it's necessary to, but one could. There's a reason you came up with that idea and not that idea.
When you were 14, Charles, you were told by an acting teacher, Jack Romano, that you had a theatrical personality. How did you react to that?
Well, I was so bad in this class. I was never good in acting class either, really. And I think as a young gay kid, it's really just in an acting class, I couldn't really, I wasn't comfortable enough with myself to sort of know how to somehow play a, you know, a heterosexual, you know, boy. It was almost like I was a space alien trying to imitate human behavior. But I guess Jack, this very flamboyant teacher, just observing me in the room, thought I had a bit of a flamboyant personality. I don't know why, obviously, I really don't, but I guess he picked up on it. So when he gave me his sort of private critique of my, where I was in the class, he said, you know, you listed my deficiencies, but that's a, however, you do have a theatrical personality that might serve you well. And I think he was quite, the word prescient, is that it? That was my stock in trade.
And you know what? When I read that in your book, I was so taken, because when I was in law school, one of my professors said, you have a theatrical personality. You should do litigation and get in front of a jury. Ah. You're a performer. And so when I read that in your book, it took me right back to that moment. And I think a theatrical personality really means you're a born performer. But, you know, you attended Northwestern University as a theater major from 72 to 76. In your book, you expressed the frustration as a young acting student of not being considered suitable to play heterosexual roles, and that gay men were not being adequately portrayed in the theater. And you came to realize that you had no desire to play roles that were alien to your nature. So you created your own opportunities to portray female characters whose sensibilities resonated with you. Have I basically summed up the reason why you became a playwright?
I think you did. You have a lot of insight. Thank you. Yeah, I when I got to Northwestern in 1972, there really was no dramatic literature of gay men's lives, except the boys in the band. You know, this was before Torch Song Trilogy, before Angels in America. I don't know if maybe it's possible that if I had been born 10 years later, maybe I would have thought, oh, I just someday if I could just play Pryor in Angels in America. Oh, if I could only, but that didn't exist. And so, I don't think even if they did exist, I still wouldn't have done it. Now, I just, there was something I discovered, the feminine within me. Maybe it was because of all the actresses I studied. Maybe it was because my aunt and my sisters were so fascinating to me. Or maybe it's just some kind of, today we might call it non-binary, I don't know. But it was very easy for me to access within, you know, I've my male self, just this kind of female energy. I don't know what the pop phrase to call it. But when I wrote my first female role for myself, you know, I hesitate calling it drag role, my first female character that in college that I wrote, I just felt that all the ways I was awkward in playing male roles and just kind of stiff, and that none of that existed. That somehow, by channeling or revealing the feminine in me, it came from a place not of vulnerability necessarily, but authority.
And now, your play Sister Act was your first time writing, directing, and starring in a play and performing a female role. You wrote that when you first appeared in drag, it was the first time you felt comfortable on stage. You said, and I'm quoting you here, Charles, playing a female role gave me a freedom of movement and vocal variety I had never known before. Drag for me was not an expression of outrage or even satire, but rather a passageway to channel the feminine in my nature, which turned out to be a place of authority. Charles, that's really fascinating because you don't see drag as primarily an expression of defiance or a political statement, do you?
Well, not in me, but for many other performers, that's essential.
But for you, it's not.
Not remotely. That's why, I guess, in a way, you know, people have said to me, "Oh, it was so brave of you to be a play female characters and or be in drag." And it would never occur to me. I don't know. I just, it was a natural thing for me to do and natural form of expression. And I say in the book that one thing I've been fortunate is that I don't know if I got that from my aunt or whatever. I've never ever thought about or worried about what will people think. It just has never ever occurred to me. And so many people, I think, are ruled by, well, I can't do that. What would people think? Most of the choices I've made in life were, well, I think that would be fun. That'd be rather exciting to do it. Never thought twice about what will people think about it.
Well, you see, that's what makes you so compelling, because it's clear for the audience that for you, performing in drag is an authentic and sincere way to express who you are. And when you refer to being in a place of authority when you're on stage, what does that feel like?
It's a wonderful feeling of being in control, but also giving. Just being, you have the freedom to give. You know, when you're afraid, you block up, and you're not also. There's a certain selfishness that fear brings. And when you have this kind of relaxation, ultimately of being pleased with where you are and what you're doing, you then in the place where you can give to an audience and share and envelop an audience.
Your Aunt Lil, who was clearly your greatest supporter, never wanted to see you perform in drag because she felt it would create an awkward situation between you. Did that upset you?
It didn't upset me. It took me a while to understand her point of view. You know, we were so close, and yet, you know, she was a woman of her generation. First of all, you know, she was born in 1909. You know, so you know, she, as supportive as she and unconditionally she loved me, you know, she had a little problem with homosexuality, and it was more fear. I think she was so terrified that somehow people would be cruel to me, or I'd have a hard time having a career, or just all these things. It just frightened her.
Well, since you mentioned that, were there times in your career when you didn't get the respect you deserved because you were dismissed as simply a drag queen and not a serious artist?
There have been times. You know, my generation of drag performer, okay, we'll call it that, we were real touchy about the word drag queen or even drag. And we felt in the early 80s, mid 80s, late 80s, that somehow if we were called a drag queen in the press, that implied that we weren't really professional, that we were somehow just, you know, guys dressing up in a campy way for Halloween, you know, or be in a gay pride parade. You know, it's certainly not necessarily true, but that's how we felt in that day. And of course, today it's totally different when you see the performers on something like RuPaul's Drag Race, who take great pride in being called a drag queen, and I applaud them. But in my day, we thought, oh, we're not being given the respect as writers and actors, and that's really what I always just wanted to be. You know, I don't even like to think of myself that I'm performing in drag. I'm playing a female character, but I guess maybe I'm being silly about just trying to, you know, splitting wig hairs. I don't know, but that's how I've always just saw myself. That at the same time, I'm proud to be in the line of drag performers. I'm sort of the godmother in some cases to drag performers, particularly who are in the venue of theater. And so I'm if I'm not included in the history of drag, then I get all upset about that too. Oh, you can't win with me. You just can't win.
Well, you belong to two worlds, the theater world and the drag community. But to me, I would never describe you as a drag queen. You are an actor who specializes in playing female roles. That's how I feel about it. Now, you came of age in the post-Stonewall era, the early 70s, where gays, at least in the big cities, were transforming themselves from being victims to political activists, and it began to be cool and kind of hip to be gay. How did that affect your writing and your performing?
Well, in many ways, I've been fortunate that I've come along at just the right time. Mm-hmm. I think if I was born 10 years earlier, I would have had much more difficult time. Well, I was in a place where I was allowed to flourish post Stonewall. Yeah, before that, you know, it was almost illegal to play a female character, or no, it was would be unheard of. So some of the battles were already fought by the time I came along.
During the AIDS epidemic, your plays were a much needed avenue of escapism for our community. How in the world did you maintain your sense of humor during that terrible time when you lost so many very dear colleagues and friends?
It was the strangest period in for me that this we were living in this increasingly terrifying world with, it was like AIDS was like a noose that kept coming, getting tighter and tighter as the different people around you were you know getting sick and dying, and in the beginning there was nothing to be done. They would take, there was a medicine called a drug called AZT, which ended up killing people as much as helping them, but it was the only thing available at the time. It was later that the new drugs and that, you know, these incredible activists, you know, challenged the government and groups like ACT UP and TAG and then celebrities like Elizabeth Taylor and, you know, really, and then Larry Kramer who fought this battle. And yet for me, you know, we with my little troop, we came about it just at that time, and I guess we were a bit of jesters at the plague, and you know, we just, and it sort of took off. We were in kind of in the right place at the right time, and there was a need for the gay community to have some new thing of escapist entertainment and something to be excited about when they're surrounded by death and fear and prejudice, because you know, in those early days of AIDS, you know, there were, you would just hear awful things of, you know, pundits like William F. Buckley saying that, you know, that HIV people should be rounded up and, you know, and put in the camps. You know, I mean, just appalling things when you hear about it in retrospect.
I'm just so glad that we had you to give us some smiles and some much needed distraction. You've written numerous plays like Sister Act, Myrtle Pope, Psycho Beach Party, Pardon My Inquisition, Die Mommy Die, The Third Story, and The Tribute Artist. All of those plays feature twins embroiled in some sort of existential conflict with each other. Why is that theme of twins so prominent in your work?
I would imagine that most writers aren't aware of certain themes that keep popping up. And it didn't occur to me until quite a bit into my writing career that a friend of mine said, you have this same theme that comes, you know, in every play and involving kind of a twinship of two people. I said, oh, that's nonsense. And then he pointed it out, oh my God, you know. And I guess, you know, I think a theme that occurs in many of my plays is that there's the protagonist creates a false self for them to, a persona for them to somehow thrive in, and then at a certain point they find that the false self is a problem, it's they're not authentic, and they have to somehow break through that. Then they discover at the end that actually they are the false self, that it wasn't so fake. And I guess maybe that's me in some ways, with all the, as an actor playing different roles, and yet they're all probably parts of me. I don't think about it when I'm doing it, but I question whether any writer really, I mean, with Tennessee Williams, I don't know, Shakespeare, I just wonder if any of them really were that introspective to figure out, I'm coming up with this idea because maybe sometimes after the fact, you know, I think, oh, I did it again.
When you're writing a play, does dialogue come easy to you?
Yes, I really think in dialogue. Yeah.
What absolutely. A gift. In The Lady in Question, which is a 1940s wartime suspense comedy drama, you played Gertrude Garnett, a famous concert pianist who rescues an imprisoned actress. Was that one of your favorite roles?
Absolutely. Oh, I loved doing that play. It was really the greatest artistic moment for our little company, which I'm proud to say that I kept eight people, you know, with going with and paid their allowed them to pay their insurance for 7 years. It was just thrilling. It was the most beautiful production. We did it at the Orpheum Theater down in the village that had a big balcony, and it's a kind of an old romance to it, and we were all working at kind of our peak of our imagination, creativity, and it was just gorgeous. And I love those movies so much. And it was a very Greer Garson kind of role where, you know, I started off as Gertrude Garnet, and she's just this impossibly selfish, self-absorbed, glamorous international concert pianist. And through the course of the two acts, she, you know, has to, you know, come out of herself and become a heroine and help this imprisoned actress escape. And it's a love story. Oh, it was just heaven.
I absolutely loved it. I remember that play vividly. Now, of course, one of your greatest successes is The Tale of the Allergist's Wife, which originally starred Linda Lavin and Michelle Lee and got three Tony nominations, one for Linda Lavin, one for Michelle Lee, and one for you for Best Play. When I saw the play, Valerie Harper had replaced Linda Lavin in the role of Marjorie. You said that when Valerie asked you for a few acting tips, you had to do it in secret so the director would not find out. Why is it so forbidden for a playwright to give input to the actors?
It'd be telling. It's totally wrong. It's totally wrong.
Get it.
Well, it's a director, you know, you're interloping with on the director's work, you know. It's just not right, and I was wrong. But Valerie Harper was the most fascinating, energetic person, and you couldn't refuse her. I mean, she was just dazzling, and everything that you want Rhoda Valerie Harper to be, she was. You know, so she was irresistible, and the director had rehearsed with her, and the show was fine, you know, and then Lynn Meadow, the director, had to move on. She had other, you know, other shows to do and responsibilities. So I just happened to come one night to see the show and to go backstage and in this case just give Valerie support and thank her for, you know, being at the helm. And but when I got there, you know, she's so seductive. She was saying, oh, it's just that one line that Linda got a big laugh on, and I'm not getting why. And now I probably should have said, well, I'll ask Lynn, the director, to come and see it. But, you know, I was right there, and I knew. And so I was like, well, maybe if you did blah, 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 blah. And she said, well, would you come back tomorrow and see if I got the laugh? And I thought, oh, God, this is terrible. But then she just kept pushing me each night. I was like, can you come back again? There's the other line. And then there's another line. And could you just rehearse with me? And I knew that it was against all protocol, but, you know, I was getting kind of a non-romantic crush on Valerie Harper, as anybody would. And I just couldn't resist her. And it was wonderful to suddenly have a function that I had a role to play in this production, that I could coach her, give her at least little bits of advice. And Anyway,
it worked. And it worked.
But it was it technically was really not right.
Well, okay. You've said many times that you never wanted to play Marjorie because your forte as a male actress is theatrical parody, not the realistic acting style required to play Marjorie. But you did it once in 2019 in a staged reading for the Actors Fund. How did that feel?
Oh, that was one of the great nights of my performing career.
Really?
Yes, because I never thought of playing that part. It really was never a fantasy of mine. And my goal in writing that play really was that I wanted to write a big, big part for an older actress. That there weren't enough. I didn't think there were enough roles for women over 50. You know, it's just a big, big part. And it was so big, in fact, that Linda at first turned it down because she didn't think she wanted to work that hard. And then she changed her mind and did it. And it's an exhausting part. But I never thought about it. And then 20 years later, there have been a number of big, sort of, it's mostly for musicals, reunions of Broadway shows, and they would do a one-night performance for the Entertainment Fund of America. It used to be called the Actors Fund, you know, in a big Broadway house. And so Linda thought, you know, it'd be cool to do a 20th anniversary one-night stage reading where they hold the scripts of Allergist's Wife. And she looks fantastic. I mean, she could play the part today. I mean, she's in great shape, just basically looks the same 20 years later. So I assumed she'd want to play Marjorie. And she said, no. And she said, I think she thought to make it a real event that I should play Marjorie and she would play the mother, because Cheryl Bernheim, who had created that role, had died a number of years ago, and that she would ask Michelle Lee and Tony Roberts and Anil Kumar, who played the doorman, and get them back. And she's a very good producer, Linda. And so she got them together, and then she got Lynn Meadow to direct this event. And Lynn gave us her Broadway, Manhattan Theater Club's Broadway Theater, The Freedman. And it was so, so thrilling.
Was that performance filmed so we can see it?
It was filmed, but like as an archival thing that's not available.
Oh, I'd love to see that. You know, you've never had any desire to direct plays, but you've enjoyed directing movies. Why do you prefer directing movies?
I've only done a couple. I've co-directed one and directed a short subject for Showtime and then a feature. Of course, nobody ever sees my movies, but in a play, the director, you know, really is so in control of every detail, and I've known the directors I've known well. They thrive on having, you know, 12 people coming up to them at the same time and with questions that need to be answered, and they love that. They love having all the answers, or pretending to have the answers. And I'm not like that. I go, oh my God, what's happening? You know, you're attacking me. But in a movie, oddly enough, there are all these different department heads, and you know, there's the DP, the director of photography, and then there's the production designer, and then they've got their committees, and so they're asked all the questions.
Now, of course, Charles, I have to ask you about your portrayal of Nat Ginsburg in the HBO prison series Oz. You played a drag performer with AIDS who seduces an elderly mob boss and smothers him with a pillow, and then ends up on death row and dies in his sleep. But I understand that was not the death scene you were hoping for, correct?
Once again, I'm always killing somebody. I forget, that's another one. That was in the theater, that was on TV. You know, I'm always murdering someone, and I'm the nicest person, darling. Well, you know, I never pursued an acting career outside of my own work. It's just, I never have, but occasionally things have come my way. And so I was, you know, offered this opportunity to be on Oz, which was a show that I was a huge fan of. And they asked me said they'd create a role for me. And so, you know, I gave them some ideas and then they came up with this character. And the fact, I'm in the first season, I suffocated this mob boss. And so I was put on death row. And then I also had AIDS, so it didn't bode well for a third season. I was going to go somehow. They were going to get rid of me. And so I, you know, since I don't pursue an acting career, I'm not really afraid of just, you know, I'll say anything. Because so if I don't never get hired again on TV, I didn't ask for it anyway. So I wrote a note to Tom Fontana, who was the creator producer of Oz. And I knew I was going to die because they were killing everybody off of death row each week. So I said, I'm sure you have it all worked out, but if you don't, what if when I go to my execution, if I could get dressed up like Susan Hayward in the movie I Want to Live when she dies. And then, and I said, Rita Moreno, who was a regular playing this lay nun, Sister Pete. I said, then maybe Sister Pete could come into my cell and help me do my nails. And then I, with great defiance, I stalk into the gas chamber and they, you know, kill me. So I ran the next day or so, I ran into Tom Fontana on the set. And he said, I got your note and a lot of things to think about. And okay. So then finally the script arrives for my last episode, and I'm looking at it, and yep, I'm in drag as Susan Hayward, Sister Pete. She comes in, yeah, she does my nails, and then suddenly I get very faint, and she says, "Oh, you just lie down, and I'll come back in the morning. We'll finish your nails." And of course, the warden and Sister Pete and Father Mukata, they all come in, and Nat's died in his sleep. I said, no, that was the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, all your fans knew that that wasn't what you wanted. But now I want to ask you about Taboo, the Broadway musical produced by Rosie O'Donnell in 2003. Yeah. You wrote the book, but Boy George had script approval, which in my opinion was the Achilles heel for that show. Although the show ran for 100 performances, it got 4 Tony Award nominations and received high praise from the likes of Stephen Sondheim, Tony Kushner, Susan Stroman. Do you think the critics were unfairly harsh because they didn't want to support Rosie O'Donnell as a producer?
Yes, I really do. I really do.
Me too.
I'm very fond of her. She's a great, great person. And she went in, it's rare that a producer has gone into a project with the purity of motive that she had. She wanted to be involved with artists and create something beautiful, and she put her all her own money into it, and I thought it was just so awful that when the critics all criticized her for, you know, the hubris of how dare she think she could produce a show and how ridiculous putting her own money in and all that, and they ridiculed her, and yet all those same critics had written, you know, think pieces in the papers about how morning that shows have, you know, 40 corporate producers now, and there's no personal stake in it. She's exactly doing like what Ziegfeld did, you know. But I think one thing is she's so uncensored that, you know, she would go around and she really believed it. She would be saying in public, you know, "Oh, the show is so fabulous. We're going to win all the Tonys." And I said to her, I said, "Don't you think that you're setting yourself up, that they're just going to, you know, dish you?" And she said, "I can't help it. That's the way I feel." And that's really what she's like. She's uncensored. She just has, if she feels it, she has to say it.
I adore her. I just adore her. And I thought the show was wonderful, but I think if you had been allowed to do what you wanted and Boy George stayed out of the script approval business, that show would still be running.
Well, I don't know. I do think that there are too many cooks there, but I don't know. I mean, it's very hard for me to have any objectivity about it. It was not a happy experience. And so it tends to color my appreciation for maybe what was there. So I just know, all I do know is that some very smart people like Sondheim, they really liked it. I was shocked. I remember I knew him a bit, and I was at the theater when he saw the show, and I saw him afterwards, and you know, he was actually sitting in his aisle seat. I happened to like be in the house, and he said I loved it, and I wept. I said, what are you weeping for, the state of the American theater? I said, no, because I loved it. It was about something. He said it was music that I ordinarily would not really like, but you know, yeah. He said, I'm he was buying it. I thought, wow, I guess, you know, maybe after reconsider this.
Yeah. Well, God bless Rosie O'Donnell. Charles, you've said that the greatest love of your life has been your creative life, not your professional life, your creative life, acting, performing, and writing. If that's the great love of your life, have you ever felt betrayed by that love?
A bit. I know it sounds very, very melodramatic, but there have been times, I think when I was, just around when I was 60, and I've read that a lot of men that, you know, turning 60 is a very difficult period. I don't know why, but I think there have been books on the subject. And I was around that age and just somehow I was at a period where I was assessing my creative output. And, oh, I just was horrible to myself. I just, it came at a really weird time that should have been marvelous, that the Lincoln Center Library of the Performing Arts asked me to donate all of my manuscripts and my papers to them. And that's a great honor.
Yeah.
You know? But, you know, I had to go through everything in preparing, you know, to give them all this stuff. I had kind of had to go through everything I'd written since like the age of 10 and rereading everything. I was just in this weird, depressed place. And I bet a lot of people can identify in their own worlds that feeling. And suddenly I was assessing my whole life's work, and I thought, oh, look, read this play. Oh, that's terrible. Looked at another one. They like that one. Oh, that's not good enough. Looked at that one. Mildly amusing. Oh, I was just like the worst critic I've ever had. And it was just really bad. And I had to somehow work my way through this. But, you know, but I think, you know, there was certain validity in some of my dark assessment, but I had to also see that, you know, try to see, well, I also accomplished this. I've had this effect on my predecessors.
Well, I'm about to give you another little injection of health. In our remaining moments, Charles, I want you to just sit back and listen to some of these amazing highlights in your life and your career. Just listen to this. In 1970, when you were only 16 years old, you met Greta Garbo in a novelty store in New York City. In 1990, at a video convention at the Desert Inn in Las Vegas, you got to hang out with Ann Miller, Debbie Reynolds, June Allison, and Esther Williams. In 1994, you got to work with Milton Berle at his one and only appearance in drag at a gay event. In 1995, you shared a dressing room with Carol Channing when you both appeared in Broadway Bear's Equity Fights AIDS. You got to work with Maxine Andrews of the Andrews Sisters in an off-Broadway musical called Swingtime Canteen. You got to play the role of Mary Haynes in a very special performance of The Women in Palm Springs alongside Lucy Arnaz, Lorna Luft, Michelle Lee, Florence Henderson, and Kay Ballard. You once got to spend a fascinating evening with Kim Novak at the TCM Film Festival. You've interviewed Julie Andrews, Terrence Stamp, Patrick Swayze, Liza, and Joan Rivers, with whom you had a very dear friendship. When Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward saw The Tale of the Allergist's Wife, they wrote you a congratulatory note saying that you had them laughing like two old whores. And Stephen Sondheim said it was the funniest play he'd ever seen. Charles, when you look back at all of that, are there moments when you have to pinch yourself to believe the life you've lived?
Yes, there's one particular thing. The first time I played the role of Auntie Mame, and it started off as a one-night event, then we ended up doing a whole tour, but I got to play Auntie Mame with Peggy Cass, recreating her original role of Agnes Gooch. And I just remember when we were doing the show and I had to drag her off stage saying, live, live, live. I thought, I can't believe, I know that I'm not Rosalind Russell, but this really is Peggy Cass. And I'm in the movie. I'm actually in the movie. And that absolutely was fantastic. I thought, this is what a life I'm living. Aren't I just the luckiest person?
Oh, that's for sure. Well, I have only one more question for you, Charles. And here it is. As you mentioned earlier, your dear mom died suddenly when you were only 7 years old, and you wrote in your book that all your life you've been searching for the perfect mother figure. Did you ever find her?
No. No, and you know, I mean, I adored Joan so much. She was a very dear friend of mine, and she was so unique. And then after she died, I don't know, I started sniffing around other old actresses trying to replace her. And people are irreplaceable. You can't. And these different ladies who are real fascinating, they didn't really need me. They had their, you know, their entourage or their fake gay son or whatever. They didn't. So I just had to accept that that I had this great friend who was so unique and just honor her. And I don't know, listen, at this age, I'm getting a little old for looking for surrogate mothers, but I guess, I've talked to other grown-ups who've lost a parent at a very young age. And it is something that stays with you. You're kind of forever marked. I would say, I bet everybody in that situation feels that way, but you know, you can't let it destroy you. You've got to, press forward.
And boy, have you ever done that. I've got to tell you, Charles, it's been such a pleasure meeting you and getting this chance to ask you about your amazing life and career. Thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Oh, thank you, Harvey. It's been wonderful.
Our guest has been the multi-award-winning playwright, actor, author, cabaret star, and drag legend extraordinaire, Charles Bush. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my director of programming, Deborah Batsafin, my PR director, Laurie Towers, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply, in-app only.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.